Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. News media brought the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, the famous swirling jar of plastic pollution in the ocean, into the public consciousness. But when Marcus Ericsson co-founded the Five Jars Institute with his wife Anna Cummins and set out to study the world's oceans with hundreds of volunteers, they discovered a plastic smog of microscopic debris that permeates our oceans globally, defying simple cleanup efforts. What's more, these microplastics and their toxic chemistry have seeped into the food chain, threatening marine life and humans alike. In his book, Junkraft, Marcus tells a story of his team's fight to solve the problem of plastic pollution. Against long odds and common sense, he and his co-navigator construct a junk raft made of plastic trash and set themselves adrift from Los Angeles to Hawaii. This morning, we talk with Marcus about what he hoped to learn and prove from his unconventional voyage and his continuing activism as a result. Marcus, welcome to Locus Focus.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, you know, as I was reading your book, there was this very strange synchronicity because all of a sudden, the place where I had been recycling my plastic lids and clamshells and plastic bags, a neighborhood natural food store, stopped having their recycling after many, many years of doing it because China has stopped the imports of this kind of plastic junk from the United States. And so every time I was reading your book and throwing plastic bags in the garbage can for the first time in years, and every time I did that, I just felt guiltier and guiltier. And I guess part of it is the images of what you pulled up in the ocean, both when you're in your junk raft and before and after that. So before we get into what is the cause of all this plastic junk and garbage and pollution in the ocean, I just want to get a sense from you of how you, as another, I'm sure you consume plastic like the rest of us, how do we deal with the fact that we are throwing away all this plastic, which we don't even want in our lives, and that it's winding up being so harmful to the planet?
I think how we deal with it, just to jump into the solution side of things. I think we all know about, you know, this amount of trash floating in our seas. But, you know, it's all upstream. If you look at the trash out to sea, and I've spent a lot of time, you know, going from island to island across each of the five big subtropical gyres, North Atlantic, North Pacific, South Atlantic, South Pacific, Indian Ocean, you get to the windward side of beaches, and it's covered in a lot of consumer products, the single-use throwaway plastics. And they're all coming from land. So there's a common phrase you'll hear called zero waste. And across the globe, there's a movement developing to zero waste our cities. I mean, zero wasting your homes, looking at the kind of packaging you're consuming, zero waste our schools, zero waste our offices, and the zero waste our communities. Many cities are now having targets for diversion rates of 80-90% of their garbage, not to a landfill, not to an incinerator, but to a recycle center or a composting facility. And then the things that can't be either recycled well or composted, take a hard look at those products. Do we need those in society? Can we meet the need that those products were meeting in a different way? And you know, you just mentioned plastic bags. It's a perfect example. Do we need thin polyethylene bags that are made from a material designed to last forever, and we use it once and throw it away, or put it as a trash can liner, then that gets thrown away? I think we're reimagining how materials flow through our society. And that was the aim of Junkraft in the beginning, was to bring attention to what are the products we're using, how are we using this amazing material, plastics, and what's the right way to use it.
Well, before we get into that, I wanted to maybe talk a little bit about oceanography for a second. You mentioned the five gyres. What are these gyres, and how do they, and what's their relationship to the way that garbage moves through the oceans?
Well, gyres are natural circulating currents. So you can imagine a piece of trash leaving the coast of Oregon is going to head straight down south, you know, towards the California coast, get to Mexico, they hit the trade winds, and head across the ocean past Hawaii to Japan, and then go up north, a Kuroshio current, and they'll get pushed all the way across back to the Oregon coast. That is gyre circulation. They're natural, you know, systems of currents. And you got five of these big subtropical gyres. Then there are six other gyres in the northern latitudes around the entire Antarctica as a circumpolar gyre. But those five subtropical gyres, they are the ones that they capture our trash. They surround these stable high-pressure systems where the wind and waves kind of slow down. And when our trash gets out there, it just sort of floats, and it begins to photodegrade by sunlight. It makes the plastics brittle. Then waves will crush it. Animals are tearing it apart. So our trash gets to the gyres, hovers there, gets obliterated into microplastics, and those microplastics feed what we call the smog of the sea. And we have found these small particles, these clouds of small fibers and micro nanoplastics, as far as Antarctica, near the equator, in the Arctic. We were in the Arctic just last year. At 72 degrees north, there were clouds of microfibers and microplastics emanating into those waters. So as our trash enters these gyres, these natural systems, they get caught up and create the smog of the sea. In our junk raft, this plastic bottle boat, we made from 15,000 plastic bottles. We stuffed into fishing nets, made these giant pontoons, put a Cessna airplane on top of this junk raft. Our objective was to ride the gyre currents from the coast of California. We were dragged offshore and then let go. And it took us 88 days, a full 3 months, to drift to Hawaii, riding those gyre currents.
So you were basically following the path of garbage?
Exactly. And that was a demonstration to show people, if we lose our trash from land, here's where it's going. In our case, we were able to steer a little bit. Our raft, by the way, was the worst sailing vessel on the planet. We're basically just drifting, riding the currents. We had a 12 by 12 foot square piece of sail. No motor, no chase boat, just riding those currents. And it's the same path of trash. And you get to the middle of the ocean, and you know, when you stand on the deck of a boat in the middle of this mythical garbage patch, you see this open blue water. If you look carefully, you'll see maybe a buoy on the horizon, some fishing net and some rope will drift by. But if the waters happen to slow down and stop, you become becalmed. Or you drag a net. Then you get a handful of this kaleidoscope of this multicolored confetti. And that's what the gyres are full of, this multicolored confetti of small broken down plastics. You don't know what product it is. You don't know what country it came from. We're not going to solve the problem by going in the ocean and trying to grab these trillions of particles of plastic. It's all going to start from on land, cutting off the tap of trash from land to sea.
Well, I found it interesting because we all started hearing about the Great Garbage Patch, as your publicist mentions, many years ago, actually. And I think it came to major light when that plane crashed in the was off the coast. I'm trying to think of which Asian country.
Out in the Indian
Ocean. Right, yeah. Exactly. And CNN was out there looking for the plane for weeks, but they didn't find the plane, but they did find the garbage. And again, I sort of gave people the sense that there was this big patch of large plastic things floating in the ocean. So how did that myth get started, and how was it debunked?
Yeah, it's fascinating. So, you know, I'd say 15 years ago, more than that, almost like 18 years ago, Captain Charles Moore published a paper based on 11 long trawls he did. He dragged his net 11 times for maybe 20, 30 miles at a time. And he pulled up these handful of multicolored confetti in his net. He surveyed the area. His transects covered an area about as big as Texas. Long transects. So he was calling his study area as big as Texas. Then another oceanographer, Curtis Ebsmeyer, in Tacoma, Washington, he said, well, you had these garbage patches based on the center of the subtropical gyres. Media grabbed those two concepts, Texas size and then garbage patch, put them together, and the myth of an island was born. And, you know, it was, I have to ask myself, and I can ask you this, and we can talk about this, it was good for the issue, perhaps. It got the world saying, hey, what in the world is this island you're talking about? But then there was a lot of blowback because now we have to explain it's not really an island. You can't go out there and plant a flag or buy real estate. It's the reality is this smog. And this idea of smog, that came from the work that I've done with my colleagues. I've led 20 expeditions, over 60,000 miles of sailing across all five subtropical gyres, including the Bay of Bengal and the Great Lakes. And we have consistently found, you know, it's mostly small stuff. It's mostly microplastic. And we published the first estimate of all plastics, all sizes, in all oceans. And those numbers were 269,000 metric tons from 5.25 trillion pieces of plastic. Everything, about 93%, smaller than a grain of rice. So that's a transition from the garbage patch myth to the smog of the sea.
Now,
metaphor, in my opinion.
Do you think the smog of the sea is catching on? Because I still hear people talking about the garbage patch.
It's catching on. And of course, there's going to be some transition. But I think people are realizing that it really is a smog. And the smog metaphor makes more sense. If you think of how we dealt with air pollution. I mean, I'm standing here right now in Los Angeles. In the 1970s, the issue of smog over L.A. and our big cities was a grim reality. You could look up and see, you know, these black clouds. You'd land an airplane, and at some point on the horizon, the city would disappear. You couldn't see laterally through this smog. And it was trillions of small bits of soot and other hydrocarbons that carried its own degree of toxicity, and they were spread far and wide over a large area. Microplastics and nanoplastics and microfibers are the exact same thing. They're tiny particles over a large area, and they carry their own burden of absorbed toxicity. So calling it a smog, well, back in the 70s, people looked up and said, okay, there's a smog. We're not going to clean this up by collecting it with vacuum cleaners in the air. No, we have to stop the source. And they did so by requiring catalytic converters on cars and better scrubbers on the smokestacks of coal-burning power plants. For plastics, the same way. Prevention. It's 100% about prevention. You stop the source, and then over time, the ocean's going to kick out that trash. And I guarantee the ocean will kick it out. I find trash heaped up on the windward side of islands. Ocean is constantly spitting out this, regurgitating this trash. We got to stop the source.
Well, there's also like a shift in consciousness you talk about in the 70s. I think there was a period, probably going back to the 50s or earlier, where the smog of L.A. was just kind of taken for granted. That's what L.A. is. It's smoggy before people started realizing maybe the consequences of that on one's health. And I'm thinking when I first came to Oregon and I had these friends who took me to the beach for the first time on the Oregon coast, and they were talking about all the exciting things that you see floating up on the coast. And there's, of course, the famous floating glass balls, which are fishing weights that come from Japan, which are very beautiful, and they're glass, and they arrive relatively intact on the beach. And then they said, and this plastic from Japan, which I sort of scratched my head and thought, why is it so exciting to see plastic from Japan? Well, I think it was the idea that this plastic traveled all the way across the Pacific Ocean, not quite as intact as the floating glass balls. But that I think back in 1971, 72, people weren't questioning so much about what does it really mean? What's the implications of having all this plastic washing up on our beaches? What do you think has shifted our consciousness? I don't think these same friends today would be very excited about finding plastic from Japan on the Oregon coast.
You know, I think it's recognizing harm, knowing the threat. And I just read an article about, you know, how the world responded to nuclear war, how we responded to climate change. And over time, you begin to see that this compilation, this buildup of threats and harm. At some point, you get to a tipping point, and the world says, we've had enough. And then you begin to demonize the source of the problem. With nuclear war, I think there is such an aberration to what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The world had zero tolerance for another nuclear war. With climate change, we're seeing an increase in the United States. Very, very quickly, we're seeing an increase of people saying, okay, this is real. We're tired of the storms and all the impacts. And there's a shift that's happening. I think with plastics, we're seeing the same thing happening as, you know, shows like yours today, what we're doing right now, increasing people's understanding of where the science is, where the harm really is, and how you and I are personally affected, and how our kids are affected, how our communities are, the environment, economically how we're affected. We're going to get to a tipping point very soon when the world will realize we don't need this single-use throwaway plastic junk trashing our planet and our people. And I think we're getting there.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Marcus Erickson, who has written a book called Junk Raft, based on his travels on a junk boat made of plastic bottles and other pieces of plastic junk from California to Hawaii, following the five gyres of the subtropical Pacific Ocean. Let's talk about one of the things I want to say about your book is I thought when I first it was pitched to me, I thought, oh, it's another one of these adventurer environmentalists who's more into the adventure than the environmentalism. And I started reading your book, and what I really loved was it's really about the story of plastic, and you just weave your excursion through it, but it's much, much more about what the issue is than the adventure that you had, though the adventure is quite interesting as well. But I'd like to talk about sort of the history, a very brief history of plastic, because one of the plastics, the early plastics you mentioned is Bakelite, which I only learned about maybe 20 years ago. And I remember those telephones from the 50s, those hard plastic telephones. But plastic was once, when it was first, when it came out in the form of Bakelite, was something that was supposed to last. And those telephones were made to last forever as opposed to what we have now. So I wanted to talk a bit about the shifting consciousness between having things that are built to last and this movement, which is really fueled by plastic and nylon and other petroleum products, of a throwaway culture.
It's interesting. You know, it's a shift in economics away from planned obsolescence, well, from conservation to planned obsolescence. And that's happened around World War II. You think just prior to the war, the Great Depression era, our great-grandparents, our grandparents, they don't throw anything away. There was that culture of conservation prior to World War II where things are scarce and things are made to last. And then come the 1950s, this idea, this growth in economics, in order to sell your product and have a return customer, the idea was to design obsolescence, to design unfashionability and disrepair into products, design it in. And it has worked if you don't factor in the true cost of this convenience, these products. I can say one example. I've got, in my kitchen, I have an old O'Keefe and Merritt gas stove, built in the 40s, built to last. The economic model, Perhaps it didn't work because once you buy one, you don't need another. You might have some maintenance way down the line. So that company, their growth was coupled with population growth. So they were very tied to that, whereas other companies that make blenders and cars and clothing, one button falls off, one tear, and you throw it away. You go get a new one. That idea, at the same time, making the management of waste a problem of you and I and our communities and taxpayers and not the companies who make the stuff, leaving those costs, the burden of that to the taxpayer, to the community and not the company, it allowed companies to make a lot of throwaway stuff. And that's created mountains of trash. I mean, I have family in Florida. I go visit them, and the highest thing on the horizon are landfills in every community. And now there's no place to put it. There's no place to put this stuff anymore. So I can envision the next, you know, couple decades, a large transition to more repair and restore economies. And we're seeing more of that happen.
Well, I think that there's a lot of us feel kind of pushed into this throwaway culture that we really are very resistant to ourselves. And I mean, the thing to me is, like, computers is an example of something where I actually have a bunch of really great computers. The newest one, I think, is about 4 years old, and which, you know, I think a four-year-old car, that's like a brand new car. With a four-year-old computer, it's already seeming like it's kind of obsolete. But I'm really determined to keep these computers alive as long as possible. But you run into all these problems with the world just running past you. And I think about the other model, which really disturbed me, was like the idea of LED lights. We finally have light bulbs that don't burn out for 20 years or maybe 10 years, but if you use them all the time. But, you know, this is like definitely against the throwaway culture. So I was reading about different companies that are making LED lights that are trying to add technological aspects to the lights that will become obsolete within a year. So you're still going to have to replace your light bulb in order to stay technically current. How do we get out of that? Because that, to me, is like, that's one of the things that's driving it even more than those runs in nylon stockings that you describe in your book, which made nylon stockings, like, I guess, the first throwaway items.
Those were the first on nylon stockings. And, you know, our last expedition we did, we sailed from Bahamas to Bermuda and then to New York City. And in New York, we ended our trip. The boat pulled up at Dead Horse Bay in Brooklyn. That's the landfill that shut down in the 1950s. And out of there, you've got, I found some Bakelite glasses, some shoe soles. I found electric sockets all made in Bakelite. And nylon stockings at the very top of the landfill. Tons and tons of nylons. That was the beginning of this planned obsolescence. How do we get out of it is a challenge, because our entire economy is based on growth tied to this economic model of creating obsolescence. I think flipping that to a repair society and restore society, a service industry that values the long life of products and exists economically by maintaining those for their customers. I mean, it's not going to be as lucrative as making something once and giving to your customer, and they use it and it breaks within a year, then you got to buy another one. I mean, that's been the model. It doesn't sustain. I think the ways to flip this, one, is ensuring that industries that make stuff are responsible for the full life cycle of stuff. And that's called EPR, Extended Producer Responsibility. And we're seeing more of those bills come online. So, you know, in your community, when you as a consumer or your elected officials, press them on EPR. Are they going to push any EPR legislation? And what that's going to do is going to reverse that model of just making stuff and taking no responsibility for its end life, to then designing into that a system of recovery, of reuse, of recycling. If you're making a product, a blender, for example, and you have no responsibility for where it's going to be in 5 years, then you're going to design all kinds of inefficiencies and obsolescence into it. But if you've got to take it back, you've got to deal with it, and you're going to design into it systems to repair, to dismantle it easily, to recover the materials, to reuse those materials. So EPR legislation is our best way to get out of this single-use throwaway mentality.
Well, I just was thinking, I was recently in the vacuum cleaner repair store with my vacuum cleaner, getting it repaired, and this woman brought in her vacuum cleaner and was told that, and this is, I think she had like a $300 vacuum cleaner, and the roller was shot or something, and for this particular vacuum cleaner, they didn't make parts for anything except for the bags. And so she had a basically, and she's looking, I bought this 18 months ago, and he said, well, I'm sorry, you know, you're going to have to buy a new vacuum cleaner. So then I talked to the service guy that I was dealing with, and I said, well, because he listed all these different brands, like Hoover, you know, which used to make really good vacuum cleaners. And there's a whole bunch of them, which I thought were supposed to be good vacuum cleaners, that are all now on this model of it's disposable after 18 months. Fortunately, the vacuum cleaner I have, he said, this should last 10 or 12 years. And I'm thinking, well, the Hoover that I replaced with this vacuum cleaner lasted for 17 years. So we are, this is, the idea now that something that lasts for 10 years is good. I mean, my mother had the same vacuum cleaner the whole time I was from nursery school to going away to college. So I think that there's also, besides putting pressure on the producers, that we have to really change some mindsets, that consumers need to rise up and say, no, it's not okay that all these appliances that I'm buying are disposable and that they, you know, are not expected to last more than a year or two.
Yeah, you know, I have a similar story. My mother has a sewing machine that she's had since I was born. It's almost 50 years ago, and it still works. It's fine, and she can still get parts for it. So I think the model exists for a repair and restore economy. It's already there. I mean, here in L.A., near my house is a cobbler that repairs shoes. And if you buy a nice pair of shoes, they should last you, you know, your entire lifetime. My father has a pair of shoes he bought when I was a kid that he still wears, and he gets the soles replaced. So I think the economic model, it's still there. It's and like you said, part of it is convincing consumers to buy into it. And the other is having our leadership, our policymakers, that insist on some form of it for the biggest polluters. Because the ones who are making the vacuum cleaner, like you just mentioned, that's designed to fall apart. You can't buy parts for it 2 years later when one little knob, one little belt goes awry. Those companies are not going to succumb to market pressure as quickly as policy. If they're responsible, they have to take back their vacuum cleaner. And I'll give you one great example. The country Chile just passed the most ambitious EPR bill. And what it does, it requires the company to take back their exact product, a percentage of it, each year. For example, if it's a soda company like Coca-Cola, they have to get back their branded bottle. And what it does, it incentivizes them upstream to create the systems of recovery, and to design the bottle so that they can easily recover it, separate the labels from the caps, from the bottle, and process those materials. If we had that in the United States, in our cities here, I guarantee you wouldn't see many companies selling vacuum cleaners that become trash in 18 months. Because then when that company takes it back, they got to dismantle it. They got to deal with all those parts. It'll be an incentive to make it last longer and develop more of a service economy, restoration and repair, rather than just single-use throwaway in 18 months.
Well, I want to get back to this a little bit later because I think this is like one of the activism pitches we need to work on. But I want to get back to right now what these plastics are that are in the ocean and what causes them. I mean, we've talked about why they accumulate the way they do, but what's the source of this material and where is it winding up besides on the beaches of Indonesia?
Sure. If we look at, you know, what's out there, when we sail in the North Pacific, for example, in the Northwest Hawaiian Islands, you go there and the majority of what's washing ashore is fishing gear. And that's primarily because fishing gear is designed to last in the oceans. And then you'll find a lot of bottle caps, cigarette lighters. I have found asthma inhalers and wire nuts. Actually, these things are things I found inside bird skeletons on Midway Atoll. So you've got in there a lot of durable plastics. The thicker the plastic, the longer it lasts. So toothbrushes, combs, bottle caps I mentioned, these things last because they're thick. What doesn't last long, that becomes that smog very quickly, are the thin disposable plastics, thin films, plastic bags, a saran wrap, any kind of thin film is going to degrade very quickly. Foamed polystyrene from broken ice chests to cups and plates, they don't last very long. They become that smog of the sea fairly quickly. And that's what floats. So things that are foam that trap air, like a cigarette lighter or a foam cup, are going to float and they'll enter the gyres. Same as polyethylene, polypropylene. Those two polymers, out of the many polymers out in the world, those two in particular, they float. So polypropylene, polyethylene are your bottle caps, your bags. Most of your cheap, single-use throwaway plastics are those two polymers. And they survive long journeys if they're thick enough. But what's on the sea floor? There's an unknown quantity of plastic on the sea floor, especially in our near-shore environment. So, for example, your typical soda bottle, which has a polypropylene cap, typically, and the bottle itself is likely made of PET. That's the number one on the little chasing arrow triangle. PET sinks. So if the cap is on the bottle, it'll float until the cap degrades. Sunlight, you know, makes it brittle and it falls off. Then the bottle will sink. So in many places where we take ROVs and scan the seafloor, we find hundreds or thousands of plastic bottles sunk into the seafloor. Anything polycarbonate, when I've surveyed, you know, sediments in rivers and streams near cities, we'll find lots of polycarbonate from broken taillights, from broken DVDs and CDs, and some thin films that are heavier than water that will sink and get caught in sediment. So there's an issue of with the trash floating out to sea far, far away. There's an issue of heavier than water plastics that are polluting the seafloor and the nearshore environment. And then, you know, there are some plastics that by design I call the escape artists, things like straws and bags, foam polystyrene, that are remaining in our urban environment. I was in New York a couple of years ago, and I stopped at one tree and counted 24 plastic bags stuck in the tree. I go on any beach walk here in California, and I will likely find a few plastic straws. They're the escape artists. They get through the storm drains, and they wash out to the beach. Foam polystyrene, cups and plates and broken ice chests, they fragment so quickly, you can find little dust storms, little dirt devils on the beach blowing bits of styrofoam around. So you have, you know, the plastics permeating our ocean surface, the seafloor, and our on-land environment where they're escaping and breaking down.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Marcus Erickson, who is the author of Junk Raft. We're talking about the pervasive plastic pollution throughout the planet, and particularly in the oceans and the impact that it has. How does this plastic, I mean, if things were thrown away properly, as opposed to just being left littered on the beach or on the side of a stream or on the streets or the gutters, if we threw every plastic item away, would it still have a chance of winding up where you're describing?
That's a good point, because then I would ask, you know, where's a way? If you throw it away, where is that away? Is it a landfill, your local incinerator? If it goes into a garbage can, are bags being blown out of trash cans? And then you have to think, who is going to pay for all this waste management? I know me as a taxpayer, I'm tired of having to pay exorbitant fees for waste management to manage these poorly designed products where their producers have no responsibility for their management. But you make a good point. Is it the individual who's responsible for littering? Yes, that's part of it. Is it waste management? You and I as taxpayers should pay for quality garbage cans and waste disposal? Yes. But industry also must design the right thing. And, you know, I'm not anti-plastic. We use plastic in our technologies. I'm talking on a plastic phone right now. We have plastics in safety equipment and hospitals. It has a place. I mean, half the space shuttle was plastic. But the single-use throwaway culture and those easily escapable materials, the bags, the straws, the cup lids, the little plastic green stir sticks at my favorite coffee shop, all these things are very quickly polluting our environment. So I think that the responsibility is threefold. It's the individual for litter, it's waste management, and it's the kinds of stuff we're making from plastics. Those three things need to be addressed to solve the problem completely.
Well, it seems like there's a divide. On the one hand, there's a plastic we could really live without, and you keep referring to those disposable plastic bags for groceries. And the only thing that I see them, the only reason I use them is that they're also very good for picking up dog poop. However, these are all the things I've been thinking about since I read your book. So I was thinking, well, I don't buy biodegradable dog poop bags because the dog poop always winds up in the garbage and it's not going to be in a place where it's going to biodegrade and become compost. And I was thinking yesterday, well, actually, it probably would be better if our garbage dumps were all the garbage was contained in biodegradable plastic as opposed to this plastic that doesn't really break down. So is that a thought that maybe if we started out with putting garbage in compostable plastic bags, that would be an improvement over what we're doing right now?
Well, it's interesting because compostable plastics are not as compostable as you might think. We just did an experiment. We took 20 products that were either made of PLA, polylactic acid, or PHA, another type of bioplastic. Both are made from plants, or the other is made from the off-gassing of bacteria. That's PHA. We took four sets of these products, 20 products, four sets of each, and one went in the ground in my backyard compost for 6 months, one for 12 months, one for 2 years, and the other set went under a dock in Long Beach here in California for 2 years. And I can tell you the PLA, your typical corn cup you see at parties, nothing happened to it. Nothing happens to those PLA products in those environments. The PHA cup that we had, it did degrade in the ocean completely. And on land, after 2 years, it was all cracked and falling apart. So some bioplastics might work. But the others, they'll say on the label in most cases, requires an industrial composting facility. So if you're going to have a bioplastic bag instead of a plastic bag, a bioplastic one, if it's going to go to an industrial composting facility, many are reporting today that they're still not breaking down fast enough. They need to get the volumes of compostable materials in and out of their composting facility very quickly. They want to give things, you know, 8 to 12 weeks max to biodegrade down to compost. You know, but your banana peels, your apple cores, they will do that. But bioplastics typically do not. Take much longer. They need a lot of heat. They need active microbes and a big pile of compost to be commingled, mixed with. What you're also seeing is many cities are trying to reduce the amount of the volume going to landfills, eliminate the need for incinerators, and trying to really increase their waste diversion rates. Diverting it to compost, diverting it to recycling, and whatever's left over, really analyze those materials and see if we really need those in society. And what's left, there is a harsh reality, what to do with those residuals. And actually, there's a lot of debate today between many NGOs and industry over how do we deal with that. Is there a place for incineration or some of the more modern technologies of pyrolysis and gasification? And that's where I think some of the frontline debate is happening between industry and environmental NGOs.
I want to get back to these, what are supposed to be biodegradable plastic bags. Portland, a few years ago, finally instituted food waste in our yard debris, and so this citywide composting facilities, and they're very picky about which brands of bags you could use for liners in your compost pail to put your food waste in. And one that they actually, the only one at first that they were approving was called BioBags, which are available all over and claim that they are totally biodegradable. I'm wondering if you tested those, because that's what I've been using, and in the belief that that's actually going to turn into compost.
They do. That's the one brand where it did degrade. BioBags, actually, if you leave it in your kitchen for more than a few weeks with wet food waste inside, it'll begin to degrade. So if you're weekly using BioBags to move your food waste, you know, from your home to the curb into your green bin, then BioBags work. That's an impressive product. So there are these technologies that do work.
Well, I'm wondering, would it make sense to use the larger size bio bag in my garbage can and put my garbage in that? Because once it gets to the landfill, would that bio bag still degrade?
Sure. Well, in the landfill, nothing happens. That's a tomb that encapsulates materials. It's typically anoxic, and very little decomposition happens. Some does very slowly. You do get some methane being produced by landfills from some biodegradation. But by and large, most landfills are tombs that just preserve things forever. So whether it's a bio bag or a polyethylene bag, it's not going to matter much. I know here in Los Angeles, I don't use a bag at all. You know, I have a black bin for things that go to a landfill. That's typically empty. I've got a green bin and a blue bin. But the trash goes from my kitchen, which goes right into the bin directly, right into whichever bin it needs to go into, without a liner. Same for dog poop. You know, me and most of my friends use a newspaper, a few layers of newspaper, and it's fine. You don't need a bag at all.
Actually, that was the old way that we did it until all these specialized bags came on the market. So I guess it's another thing we fall for in terms of convenience.
We do fall for it. I think we had to be taught to throw things away in the 1950s, that we knew conservation very well. I mean, all through the whole war effort, there were victory gardens. I can't tell you how many posters I've seen from the war era of save your metals, save your glass, reuse all your resources, save it for the war effort. And then came this culture of convenience, the exact opposite. Now throw it away. We had to learn, be taught how to throw things away. And now I think a shift needs to happen and is happening, a culture of not just conservation, of sort of a sensibility about what kind of world do we want. As resources become more finite, there's resource scarcity, we're becoming overpopulated very quickly, pollution is becoming much more apparent. So we're shifting to, I think, a new set of values. It's like the conservation after the Great Depression era without the Great Depression to motivate it. It's more about what world do we want to motivate a culture of conservation.
And actually maybe to prevent the next Great Depression.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Well, while you're talking about this great movement towards making producers accountable for the end use of their products and changing the mindset of consumers so that we don't buy things that are don't have a very long lifespan or don't use materials that are just going to wind up being plastic shreds in the ocean. There's also some very strong lobbying groups that are countering this message. And let's talk a little bit about some of these groups and why it's hard to get this legislation passed that you've been talking about.
Well, I think industry, you know, the industries that make plastics, make the plastic itself, those are the petrochemical companies, then the folks that actually make products from those plastics. Companies like Johnson & Johnson and others that make the products. They are invested in making more and more and more plastics. Their economic growth has been on a vertical climb, about 4% a year for the last 50 years. The only way to maintain a market for their products is not to have recycling get really good. It's an interesting sort of counter message. Recycling is wonderful, but if it starts to compete with the need for new plastic pellets, then it counters your economic model. So what we're seeing is a greater reliance on some of these waste-to-energy technologies. And it's largely just to save the market share for the companies that make plastics. If recycling got good, if you think of right now where recycling is in the United States, the EPA reports on how materials flow through our country. Of the plastic made, less than 10%, about 9.2%, gets recycled. That was a 2013 estimate. 9.2%. That's a failure. If your kid came home with 9.2% on a test, you would ask, what's wrong with that school? So that's where we're at on recycling. If recycling got really good, if recycling pushed over 50%, there's a less and less and less need for new plastics. And that's counter to the economic model of some of the big plastic producers.
Now, could recycling become good? I mean, we're running into this wall. China's no longer accepting most of our used plastic because basically, I mean, you describe it in your book, and I also heard a report on the radio last week about what was found in a lot of recycled plastic bins, and it's horrible, disgusting things. And you wonder what's wrong with people that they're throwing this stuff away and thinking, you know, it's okay for somebody else to pick through it, or maybe not even thinking about what the whole process of recycling is about. So if China's not accepting it, so we have now growing mounds of things that we thought we could recycle before, like plastic bags, like yogurt covers, yogurt lids, and clamshells. So what do we do? I mean, how can plastic recycling become improved? And what do we do? I mean, first of all, let's talk about what's wrong with the model of sending it all to China before we talk about how to improve it here in this country.
Sure. So I'd say 5 or 6 years ago, China put up what's called the green fence. And that's where they said they were tired of getting, you know, really dirty trash. I spoke with a recycler in Marin County, just north of San Francisco. This goes back almost 9 years ago. And he said, you know, I've got a choice of all my trash. I can either send it to a landfill where I have to pay a tipping fee of like $60 a ton, maybe a little more than that, or China takes it for free in empty shipping containers going back to China. You think of how many containers are arriving in the United States with goods from China. For every three that come in from China, we send one back. That means two empty containers, and they were taking our trash, as much as we want of plastic trash. And then there, because labor is cheap and environmental standards are much lower than here, they would take the trash, they bust open these big giant bales of trash and sort through it and take out more recyclables because there was cost effective because of the low standards. But China was tired of getting all this junk that had no value, that they could incinerate and make some power. They did some of that, but then they were finding, you know, everything from radioactive waste, biohazard red bags from hospitals in these bales, even ammunition, you know, unspent ammo in these bales. So they increased their standards tremendously. So now when you go look at recyclables heading to China, they get inspected first. I was at one metal recycler, and there's a Chinese label stamped on the big giant bales of coppers and metals and plastics that they've been okayed for transit back to China. That is reducing the amount of trash, amount of stuff, plastic we can send overseas, because now the standards are raised. And that's making things very difficult here in the U.S., where to put the stuff. At the same time, recycled plastic is having a hard time competing with new plastics. New plastic made from natural gas, the new pellets, are in many cases cheaper than recycled plastic. So you're seeing less of an incentive to use recycled content when the new stuff is a little bit cheaper. And that's where, you know, our cities, if the true cost were factored into the cost of plastic waste, then those brand new plastics that people are buying today, companies are buying today, wouldn't be as valuable as a recycled material. It wouldn't be as cheap or cheaper. Like if you bought new plastics and you knew you got to add another, you know, $1 per kilo of what you purchased because the maintenance on the back end, the management of that waste on the back end is just costly. those true costs would make recycling more viable. And what we need is true costs and EPR.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Marcus Erickson, who wrote a book called Junk Raft. We're talking about the pervasive plastic pollution throughout the world and the challenges of finding both to live without plastic and to find a way to recycle the plastic we have. Well, speaking of making plastic from natural gas, or a product is called methanol. Actually, here in the Northwest, we're fighting two proposed methanol refineries that would be producing methanol that would be shipped to China, basically, to make plastic in China. And so that brings the whole struggle home. I mean, this very large movement, or growing movement, focused around the Kalama, Washington proposed facility. And people are starting to become aware. I mean, it's not just the problem with that refinery itself and all the toxic hazards that it has, but it's also creating a whole new infrastructure of natural gas pipelines to get the natural gas to the refinery in Kalama, and just kind of reinforcing our dependence on natural gas. So I think one of the things that we need to be talking about, besides talking about our concerns about plastic, is to talk about the evil of natural gas, and that natural gas is not a carbon neutral clean energy as it's been touted. It's not natural. In fact, it's methane, and most of it's fracked. So do you see a way of tying that into your discussion about how to stop our use of plastic?
For sure. I think you have to talk about climate change. We can talk about, you know, all these impacts. So with plastics, it's all fossil fuel-based right now, using natural gas to make most plastics we use today. So I think tying it to where the carbon comes from to make these convenient materials, the connection is clear. And that brings me, you know, back to the first idea we talked about was zero waste. You know, it's zero waste in terms of what we extract from the ground to combust, to make power, and what we extract from the ground for chemistry. We're either making energy or making chemistry from fossil fuels, and both are polluting. And in both cases, the industries that extract and make the materials from it, make the power from it, aren't bearing the true cost of those materials to society. So I think, you know, they're both the same fight. They're both the same fight to create a zero-waste culture. So that's what we see, you know, in our city here in Los Angeles, and I know in Portland as well and around the West Coast, we're seeing more and more cities very quickly adopt these zero-waste principles. At the same time, you're seeing transportation efficiencies increase. Like here in Los Angeles, they just purchased, I think, 90 brand-new electric buses. Getting ourselves off of fossil fuels for energy and for chemistry, and trying to approach these zero waste models. That's where I see the future in both those fields, in climate change and in plastic pollution.
Well, I think about plastic, about it not having to necessarily be the evil that I think it is in many ways. There was a book that came out in the 70s by a guy named Ernest Kallenbach called Ecotopia, in which the West Coast secedes, actually the Northwest, starting going down as far south as Santa Cruz, secedes from the United States and creates its own country called Ecotopia. And most of it was kind of silly and sexist. But there was a very interesting notion that he had. This is like, I think, in 1975 or 76, about totally compostable plastics. And he talked about there being two plastics that they use in Ecotopia. And one is the long-term plastic that would, you know, would stay intact and be safe and not leach, and you could use it for the kinds of things that you were describing that we need plastic for. But for disposable plastic items, it would be made to be totally plant-based again, but it would be designed to decompose within a couple weeks. And it would be completely plant material, so it would be completely compostable. Are we anywhere close to being able to create plastics like that that would be totally, that could decompose back to nature safely?
Sure. You know, I think we are with PHA, polyhydroxyl alkanoate, made from the off-gassing of bacteria. It is a more compostable plastic. In our little study we completed recently, a PHA beach toy, a thick cup, degraded in the ocean in 2 years. It was gone. So PHA can it can work, but I would not want to see the single-use throwaway culture using this bioplastic to replace petroleum-based plastics. I think what we want to create is for the throwaway objects, and there are some throwaway things that we will continue to use in hospitals and elsewhere, to use things that fit a more natural cycle. not a technical cycle. So technical materials are our metals, our electronics, our plastics. Creating in that area a system of recovery and reuse and recyclability of materials, material capture. Whereas in the natural cycle, for the single-use throwaway products, going back to paper in some cases, like paper straws, paper bags, or reusable materials, preferably, creating objects that fit in a natural cycle, things that are lost very easily, the products that are escape artists, like the bags and the bottles and the straws I mentioned, napkins, for example, there's no problem making those out of paper. So either it has to fit a natural cycle or a technical cycle, and in that case, you got to have really good recovery systems in place. So that's where I can see the future of materials in this throwaway culture. Not necessarily going back, going to bioplastics, but going to things that fit better in a natural cycle. And I don't think bioplastics are quite there yet.
Well, I'm a little concerned about being too reliant on throwaway paper, because then you have to deal with all those trees. And I mean, where are you going to get that paper from?
Yes. Yeah, I agree. I'd much prefer to see us go to reusable materials. You know, I wanted to add one little caveat about bioplastics. I've spoken with a couple firms. There's one called Metabolics that was a big effort. I think Archer Daniels Midland had funded them to make bioplastic and try to make them at scale so that they can get a piece of the market. They didn't survive because it's a little more expensive to make PHA. They were able to find markets in the thin films for agriculture and to make products used in aquaculture, where they need like little tags on lobster traps to degrade within a year. Or on thin films, over strawberry fields, where they can maintain the water under the thin film and reduce the amount of weeds that grow. So those are the two applications where the PHA manufacturers see a future. And they don't see a future necessarily in the single-use throwaway market to replace plastic bags with bioplastic bags or plastic straws with bioplastic straws. I think that they agree that that might be a case where something that more fits a natural cycle or not at all.
Well, we've seen here on the West Coast a lot of cities, and I think, does California now have a total ban on plastic bags that's statewide?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, I mean, Oregon, it's still city by city. It's very odd because I live in Portland, but I often shop out in Clackamas County, and I was very surprised one day when I was shopping at the store and they were offering me a plastic bag. I said, that's not allowed anymore. They said, we're not in Portland, with a certain amount of pride. So how do we so I think the plastic bag bans are very effective. It seems, I mean, maybe I'll ask you.
Do you think they are?
Yeah.
This is a very important point. I'm glad you brought this up. There is something called preemption, where industries are, the industry tactic now is to create statewide legislation at the state level that prevents cities from passing ordinances that ban products. So if your city, for example, in Florida, where preemption has passed, if Orlando or Miami or Fort Lauderdale, they tried to ban plastic bags, then the industry can call the state policy, call preemption, and say, you're banned, you can't ban those plastic bags. It's effectively a ban on bans. And it's crippling the ability of communities to take their own leadership on these issues of single-use throwaway products. So that's the industry tactic now, and it's worked in Florida, it worked unfortunately in New York, and a few other states. California did pass a statewide ban, and they were able to preempt preemption by having the ban at a statewide level. But by industry pushing preemption, it's really attacking the grassroots movements that are doing, you know, that are going city by city and culminating in a state ban.
So do you see any, because actually in Oregon, we tried to get a statewide ban and through the legislature, it didn't happen. So now it's just the cities. And I think there's a lot of cities in Oregon that have the plastic bag bans, but it's still a matter of contention. Do you see any way to get around the ban on bans and maybe do a ban on ban on bans?
That's the next step, yes. But I think also just to keep track, and note, that's one thing the movements are doing in the United States, many organizations working on this, is keeping track of where preemption happens or is being tempted, and to really focus on stopping that cold. how to stop Florida's ban on bans. I speak with a few activists in those cities. One just recently in Miami, and they say they're going forward with their bans. They're going to push their ban and push their policymakers in the city to address the issue at the state. And it's on the grounds of taking away individual rights to determine what to do in your community.
Right. Well, actually, we also have, what's it called? Well, not local rule, but there's a name for it, where basically communities have certain rights to make their own rules apart from what would be imposed from them from above. Well, if people want to know more about your work and how to get involved, how do they get a hold of you?
It would be to go to 5gyres.org. That's the number 5, G-Y-R-E-S.org. Lots of information there. And to get involved, one great way is our foam free campaign. We see foam polystyrene as the next frontier to eliminate the single-use throwaways.
Well, great. Well, it's really good talking with you, Marcus. I really enjoyed your book, and I highly recommend it. It's called Junk Raft, and it's subtitled An Ocean Voyage and a Rising Tide of Activism to Fight Plastic Pollution. So thanks for all the work that you're doing.
Thank you so much. Thanks for this time.
Sure. We've been talking with Marcus Erickson, who's author of Junk Raft, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, we're going to talk about mega wildfires one more time, this time with Colin O'Mara, who's with the National Wildlife Federation. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by the Bobs. Thanks for listening.
Bag it up. 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 Bag it up.
A person's home should be their castle. When I'm at home, I want to feel like royalty. But I don't want to be the queen of this man. Never before have I seen such misery. Living with my baby is a hassle. When he's at home, he doesn't care, never combs his hair. Putting him out on the curb unless he cleans his garbage. But my baby loves trash. My baby leaves his trash all over the house.